For those of you who came in since the earlier part, I just wanted, I'll introduce myself again. My name is Asha, and I'm visiting our ashram here and visiting Swamiji for just 2 weeks. And since I was here today, people asked if I could speak. My home is in Palo Alto, California, near San Francisco, where my husband and I have an Ananda community, a more developed community, a developed version of what all of these souls and Swamiji have come here to build in Pune and elsewhere in India. My own experience with Swamiji goes back now almost 40 years. Someone was saying to me recently with the kind of incredulous excitement that I remember when I was 20, of being on this path for all these years. But the oddest thing, of course, that we all experience is that we're always just living in the present moment. And whatever is behind us is there, but it's not as if you stand at this moment with the accumulated memory of all of that. Think of 40 years in one incarnation. If you added up all the lifetimes that we've lived, it really is just less than a blink of an eye in eternity. But the person actually asked me the question, what is it like to have known Swami Kriyananda, who's the inspiring heart of all that we're doing. And I said, well, what it's done for me from a very young age is given me a very clear direction in life. I was fortunate enough to be 22 years old when I met Swamiji. He walked into a lecture. I had attended Stanford University in California. I have to say honestly that I flunked out, but I did get in. And I flunked out because I was looking for wisdom. And I had hoped that at a prestigious university like that, my professors would also be wise. In about 10 days of being in the school, I realized that they weren't wise. So I lasted through the year, but I rarely went to class, which is what happened at the end. But I stayed in the area, which was God-inspired, because not long after, Swami Kriyananda in 1969 gave a lecture at that university. By that point, my quest had reached the level where I knew about self-realization. I knew about the idea of the teachings of which you all have grown up with, but of course in America you had to discover them. I'd found the Bhagavad Gita and the Mahabharata and the Ramayana and Swami Vivekananda and others. But I was absolutely stymied as to how to make the transition from thinking that these were marvelous teachings and so clearly what I had been looking for into something other than just getting up in the morning. Is this close enough? I didn't think so. I kept trying to sit forward. Can I do that, Vijay? Is that okay with you? Yeah. I feel more comfortable now. Yeah. Thank you very much. I was persuaded that there was a goal in life, and that goal in life was, as I understood it, self-realization. I was a little fuzzy on the concept of God, but I had this idea that a certain kind of self-expansion was possible and that that self-expansion would bring greater and greater happiness. I had a very clear objective from a very young age, which was that I was determined to be happy. And that seems like a fairly obvious aspiration, but I observed that distinct from the people around me, it was the only aspiration I could imagine that would be worth pursuing. I couldn't see what would be the point of becoming a doctor or a professor or a millionaire or anything else if it didn't bring with it a certain kind of happiness. And the second characteristic I noticed that was different about me than most of the people I knew is that I was willing to try to work hard at being happy. I wasn't just sort of waiting and then going to mourn and mourn when it didn't happen. I was willing to change myself. But nonetheless, even with that much of clarity, and even when I was 18 and was handed a book about Ramakrishna and Vivekananda and began to sort of get a perspective that nothing in my American upbringing had given me, I was still lost because I was still getting up in the morning, just going to work, making some feeble attempts to meditate, and then just coming home and fixing my dinner and then going to bed so I could get up and go to work the next day. And it was I really, very quietly, I've always been a very practical person, but I began to think, I'm going to have a nervous breakdown. I thought, if you have a nervous breakdown, it will just be very tiring and probably expensive, and at the end of it, you'll be sitting exactly where you are. It's not going to take you anywhere. And I, above all, I wanted to go somewhere that was a forward direction, and I was in that state for quite a few years. I began to read books about the saints. I read the Mahabharata, I read the Ramayana. I started reading saints east and west, every one I could find. In retrospect, I realized what I was trying to do as I was trying to figure out how you actually lived it. It was one thing to read about it. It was one thing to be very clever and be able to talk about it. But it was quite different to think, how can I really make this the experience of my life? And I was right in that state of mind, very deeply in that state of mind. And the problem was, you know, I would read about Ramana Maharshi, who lived, you know, on the mountain there and sat under the tree and went into the cave and sat in silence for months at a time. And the devotees came, and I was living in downtown San Francisco, and I really could not figure out how that one would translate. So I read about St. Francis, and he lived outside in bare feet, and then he washed the feet of the lepers, and he renounced everything and begged from door to door. And I looked out my window in San Francisco, and I couldn't see how that one was going to work out either. And it was this sort of ever-increasing, very quiet sense of desperation. I think it was Thoreau, an American philosopher, who said, most men live lives of quiet desperation. And I really began to understand that. There was nothing wrong. I've always been capable of success. I've been very fortunate in my life. And that was what made it all the worse. There was nothing wrong. If I'd had a life-threatening illness or, you know, horrible abuse from people in my life or poverty, nothing. Everything was fine, except nothing was fine. And then I went to this lecture where Swami Kriyananda was speaking. He was 44 at the time. You know, he's 82 now, so it was he was quite different then. Very strong, very powerful, tremendous. Well, he's really just the same. His physical body was younger. He walked into the room, and the distance from where he walked in into where he spoke was about the distance from that doorway to here. The room was, you know, larger than this, and I was several rows up. It was a slanted seating. I was up high. I watched him walk in, and I had, I wasn't given, and I still am not given to, you know, supernormal experiences, but he walked into the room, and this inner voice inside me said, he has what you want. And I didn't even entirely have concepts for that. I could just feel that he had made that transition. He had moved from just loving these ideas into actually making that the definition of his life. And really, before he opened his mouth, when he just walked in, I've read the story of the life of Buddha. I'm sure many of you have too. And they say that the Buddha's first sermon was when some of his first devotees saw him walking down the road. And his first sermon was the act of walking down the road. But the consciousness that had permeated him after he stood up from under the Bodhi tree was so tangible that they were instantly drawn to him. So we all know such a thing is possible, and I can only say in my own life that that's what happened. And if my life had turned out differently, you might be able to criticize the decision, but as it turned out, it was the best thing that ever happened to me, without question. And by the time he'd walked from there to here, my destiny was sealed. I knew that whatever it was that he had was exactly what I was looking for, and that I was going to do everything I could to learn what that was and to make it my own. And not long after that, I left what I was doing, which was meaningless to me anyway, and went up to the ashram that Swami Kriyananda was starting. In the course of his talk, which I remember nothing of, I only remember him speaking, and afterwards I had a second strong intuition, which was, this is the most intelligent man I've ever met, which for me I always felt was God's little gift to me, because I like intelligence. I enjoy it. I enjoy articulation. And so there he was. Not long after I gave myself over to the life in the ashram, and it was very, very primitive then, just almost bare land, slightly more than the land that we have out here now, but very little more. Living in little trailers and actual teepees, cloth buildings, and tents, and having no electricity, no indoor plumbing, no money, nothing, except this extraordinary sense of divine purpose. And looking back now, I was you would call me a founding member of that community, and since that time I married, and my husband and I have really started a second community in Ananda, California, and I was also involved in helping to start a couple of others, although not as deeply. And, you know, I speak, I travel, I've written a book, you know, all these things happen. And this work that was just nothing virtually but bare land and this extraordinary individual has turned into a worldwide movement, all of these things we can point to. But I wouldn't say even now that any of that was really the deep sense of purpose that we felt in those early days before any of that was even dreamed of. Swami Kriyananda, I think, always knew, but he never told us. He just let us live our lives in a more spontaneous way and grow into things naturally. But the deep sense of purpose was very simple, which was there is a center point to life, and that center point is our relationship to higher consciousness, our relationship to God, which was not a word I could use very easily at the beginning because it didn't have a meaning to me. You're more fortunate in this country because you have a greater understanding of the divine as a living experience. In the West, the word God essentially means nothing in particular. But the living experience was what it was that created that inner sense of purpose. And I was not then, you know, a particularly deep meditator. It wasn't as if the heavens opened up and, you know, God spoke to me or anything like that. But what began to pulse through the experience of my life was the single thing that I had always been seeking and always known I was seeking, was a deep sense of inner happiness. You know, and that all the conditions that we were living with, which some people would have considered primitive or insecure or who knows what, it never even crossed our minds. I'll be collective in that. It certainly never crossed my mind, never crossed my mind for a moment that any of those things made any difference compared to after what had felt to me like ages of longing, even though I was still a young person, this final realization that there was a purpose to life and that purpose to life could be experienced. I remember an early, very, very early experience there when a man who had been in the community in the ashram longer than I, Binai, for those of you who know him, something difficult had happened to him, and he was talking to a friend about how he had acted according to what he thought Mother wanted, but it turned out that Mother had wanted something else, and so now he was trying to understand what it was that Mother wanted. And I knew, in America, young men don't really listen to their mothers like that. And I couldn't really figure out what he was talking about. And then I heard that what he really meant was what he called, at that time, Divine Mother, which, of course, is a concept, again, you all are more familiar with, but in the West it was a very new idea. And I was both utterly confused and completely enamored by that idea. The thought that there could be a power in this world that was so personally involved with our well-being that we could call it Mother. And that we could have a relationship that would be so close that even the smallest details of our lives could be guided by that motherly love. You know, what else is it that we're seeking? And it was so interesting, has been so interesting through these years to sort of see that reality acted out through Swamiji in so many different ways. He's an extraordinarily powerful person, courageous person, creative, dynamic, you know, all the adjectives that you want to use, devoted. It was through him that I even knew about this line of gurus. I had seen that wonderful book, Autobiography of a Yogi. I actually even owned it. But I had never been attracted to it. But after I met Swamiji, and I went back to read it, it was as if his living relationship with this Kriya Yoga teaching, his living relationship with Paramahansa Yogananda, was so palpable that when I picked up the book, after being in contact with him, it was like through him, all of that reality began to come alive. And in the years that I was, in those early years when I was really trying to understand more what was going on, I observed in Swamiji, as I mentioned to you, this extraordinary intelligence. And I don't just mean intelligent like he can explain a philosophical point, which he can, of course, or write beautifully or any of those things. But he was able, and still is, to cut to the heart of every situation when everyone else would be baffled, you know, just couldn't quite figure out what the right decision would be or what the right answer was. And he would always just be able to just almost casually just untie the knot, and then we'd go on. And I was meditating deeply one day, and I asked myself, what is the secret of his intelligence? Because in my family life especially, that was always such a great value. And it came to me very strongly that the secret of his intelligence is the courage of his heart. And I didn't exactly at first know how to put that together. And then I began to think of many things that Master has written. When I say Master, I mean Yogananda. Paramahansa Yogananda said, reason follows feeling, is what he said. And what, if you observe yourself and observe others, whenever there is an emotional predisposition to a certain point of view, then one always finds reasons to support it. Isn't that so? If one is predisposed in a certain way, you even hear whatever other people say to you tends to support what you're thinking already. Wherever you're oriented is how your mind follows. That's how very intelligent people can do very stupid things, is because they get emotionally committed. And there's another side to it, which is often because of that emotional commitment, we develop intense likes and dislikes. We develop attachments to certain ways, and we're only even able to consider certain possibilities in life. In other words, our very perception of reality becomes limited by the preconception of the heart. The Gita, of course, talks about this in great length, about detachment, discrimination, non-attachment. So what I began to understand about Swamiji and have observed over these many years is that his only interest is in what is. In other words, what is true. True not just in a factual sense, but what is true in terms of the real purpose of life, which is finding self-realization. And that he's not protecting anything. I had at this time a very particularly intense experience where, I'll back up to give this to you, where I was desperately trying to do what God wanted me to do, and I just could not come to an answer, and I was very melodramatic at that time. And I had the opportunity to ask Swamiji, you know, what was right, and I was sitting in front of him. He was sitting in this chair, and there was sort of an ottoman between us, and I was sitting on the floor, and I was explaining this dilemma I was facing, and I was asserting with all this emotional commitment that I really wanted to do what was right. And finally, I was so overcome by the whole impossibility of my situation that I burst out crying, and I put my head on my arms, and I said, oh, it's so hard to know what God wants. So I went very impassively, kindly, but very, he wasn't reaching out to comfort me, let's just say that. He said, no, it's not. And then he gave me no other advice. So I sat there for a few minutes and tried to engage him in conversation, and we were not going anywhere, so I just went home. And I meditated on it, and I said, well, it may be easy for him to know what God's will is, but it's not easy for me. And then I thought very carefully, and I realized, no, he had not said, it's easy for me to understand God's will. He said, it's not difficult. I said, it's so hard to know God's will, and he said, no, it's not. He was speaking about the task itself. So I prayed to Master, and I prayed to Swamiji, and I said, well, why is it so hard for me to know? Immediately my inner voice said, because you don't want to know. And I was honest enough to say, I think that's right, because I was afraid to know, because I knew what God was calling me to do, and I simply didn't want to do it. And later then, when I was contemplating Swami's clarity of mind, which is more than intelligence, I realized that because he's not afraid to know. And then I began to put this together with this idea of Divine Mother. Why are we afraid? Because we don't trust in our deepest selves, even in the existence of Divine Mother. We don't believe in our deepest selves, or fear is based on the fact that there's no one looking out for us and that we're stuck here looking out for ourselves. Isn't that so? Someone talked to me, I read in a book just today, about how atheists carry so much guilt because they're responsible for everything. And it's very, very difficult to be responsible for everything because so much goes wrong. I thought that was a marvelous sort of little observation. But you see, if in fact there is an omnipresent, compassionate, all-wise, beneficent, loving force that is standing with us, even more profoundly, standing within us, and is the real force guiding our lives, what do we ever have to be afraid of? Isn't that worth contemplating? I was caught once in a very difficult family situation, and one of my family members was having a very difficult time, so difficult they were in the hospital. And it was necessary for me to be the one who was able to function well in that situation, so I was sort of holding it together for everyone else. But it was not an easy situation for me either. This is long after I was deeply immersed in these teachings. And finally I exited from the hospital, and the only private place I could find was in my car. And it was sort of dark in the evening, so I'm sitting alone there in my car, and the whole weight of all the suffering just came down on me, and I was just sobbing just helplessly in the car. And in the midst of all that crying, you see, we live on so many levels at the same time, don't we? Because it's only the human ego that is even capable of upset. The superconsciousness is never touched. The divine soul is never touched. The depth of the ocean is never touched, no matter what's going on the surface. And so even though we're often more observing the surface, it doesn't mean that the depth of the ocean of spirit within us is even ruffled by it. It's just a question of where our attention is. So there I was, caught up in this intensely human and intensely at that time painful drama, and roiling around on the surface of the ocean. But then from the depths of my devotion and my spiritual practice, which was significant enough to rescue me, this thought came rising up, and it said, is it possible that this is happening outside of the will of God? And it was sort of like, the part of me that wanted to have a tantrum was very annoyed, because suddenly I couldn't do it anymore. I couldn't continue to throw myself on the ground and, beat my head against the wall and kick my hands and protest. And then I remembered also, though, in that moment, what Master has told us about the way to pray. His book, Whispers from Eternity, which will be published here, or already is. He calls his prayers and their prayer demands. He says, we should not be like beggars before God. He said, this is our divine birthright, and everything that belongs to the infinite belongs also to us. This was the great message of Jesus also, our Father who art in heaven. We are one with that infinite spirit, and even though we have separated ourselves from it, it doesn't make it any less our own. And he said, you must talk to God in a demanding way. He calls these things prayer demands, not like a spoiled child, but like one who is asking for what belongs to you. And so there in that car, when that thought came to me, a prayer demand entered my mind. I said, all right, God, if this is your will, if you're in charge of this, you better do something for those people. And all of that anxiety, because I'm not Swamiji, I'm not Master, I'm just a person going through this like everyone else. But all of that anxiety, which I wasn't entirely able to overcome, I directed then in my intense relationship with, shall we say, the one who's in charge. If there is a divine, beneficent force, and if in the wisdom of that compassionate mother, she is giving us tests that seem difficult for us to bear, how can it be outside of her love for us? But it's very, very fair to speak your mind. You know, if you have a true and a deep and a respectful relationship with anyone, part of what makes that real is that you can and should respectfully speak your mind. Schooled as I am in the Christian Bible, there's the moment where Jesus, just before he's going to be crucified, and in the Garden of Gethsemane, this very famous passage in the Bible, Jesus says, "Lord, let this cup pass from me." And you think, well, even this master in this moment, and it wasn't for himself he was praying, it was, "Let these people receive the love that I'm here to give them instead of turning on me," as he knew they were about to. But even when he makes that statement, praying for others, then he says, "But thy will, not mine, be done." And I've always taken that with Master's prayer demand as the model way to pray. So, all right, Divine Mother, even if you're in charge, I'm going to register a protest at this point. And I want you to understand that we need to work together to make something else happen here. To finish that story, I had that very deep and very strong conversation with Divine Mother in that car. And when I went back into the hospital, the whole situation had begun to shift. It was almost as if it was just for me to have that realization. And then from then, everything began to move in a forward direction. Now, in Swamiji's life, what I was saying is what I've observed is through years and years of sadhana, through deep devotion and attunement to the Guru, for decades of service, of selfless training and giving himself to the divine will as he feels it within him, the willingness to hear God's voice and just move with it, one gradually learns that how can you say what's good and bad merely because this is comfortable or uncomfortable, pleasant or unpleasant? But in the end, it just like little children, isn't it so with little children? You know, you're raising a child and that child has its own ideas of what's going to make it into a good, happy person. But the loving mother has to sometimes be stern and say, "No, this is what you must do because I can see the future that you can't see. And seeing that future, I know that this is the only pathway to take you where you're trying to go." And we have so beautifully in our midst with Swamiji, plus the examples of all the great saints and masters in the world, there's always this interplay, isn't there? So often they're tested. So often difficulties come to them. Even it just becomes a fundamental part of spiritual life, because what we have to learn is a deeper and deeper level of actual experience, that behind everything, whether it looks to us like a blessing or a curse when it comes, we have to always be conscious of that loving Divine Mother behind it, the hand of the Guru, the hand of the mother, however we call it and ever feel it in ourselves, that is bringing us to this everlasting state of happiness. You know, it's back when I was starting this to speak here, when this person was speaking to me about 40 years of it. It's really just one day. It's one day at a time. It doesn't really make any difference. But what happens to us over time, what happens to us by steadily putting one foot after the other, is gradually that experience of the loving hand of Divine Mother behind everything comes closer and closer to the surface. And still then, until then, we have what Swamiji has, which is this great courage of the heart. Why should I even bother to have opinions? I can have feelings. I can have ideas that I can express clearly to Divine Mother. My, this seems like a challenge, doesn't it? And I love what Mother Teresa said of Calcutta. She said, "God never gives us more than we can handle. But sometimes I wish he didn't trust me so much." Isn't that sweet? Isn't that just about as dear as you want it to be? And so the whole spiritual path just comes down to the simplest things. I'll tell you one more observation and then I'll stop. In Swamiji's life and in the life of many of us, of course, that relationship with the Divine Mother becomes focused through the Guru, because it's the hand of the Guru that teaches us. And the gratitude that the devotee develops over time for that constant inward guidance begins to dominate all other aspects of one's nature. That's what I feel my 40 years of relationship with Swamiji is, that there's always been at the center of life this pulsating beam of wisdom to which one can turn, whether through books, through inner attunement, through the sound of his voice in music, through Master's eyes in his picture, this pulsating point of wisdom that in this world which whirls and the ego going here and the feelings going here and the planet and the economy going like this, there's just this steady, constant, the voice of Om, the loving presence that says, don't worry, I'm here. In a little talk that Swamiji gave not too long ago, when the American economy began to unravel, you know, a few months ago, which it continues to unravel at a very impressive pace, Swamiji said, looks like the world is falling apart. And then I guess he must have sensed, you know, a degree of anxiety at such a casual remark. He said, oh, but don't worry. He said, God is in charge. Just like that. There's a similar in the Bible. Jesus says to his disciples just before he's about to die, he said, you know, the world will persecute you because you're my disciples. Because often when we stand up strongly for the light and try to commit ourselves to the light, the counterforce, whatever you call it, Maya, Satan, negativity, whatever it is, it always tries to take it away from us, because this is a pearl of great price. And we can't attain it just by saying, oh, gee, it would be nice to be God realized. No, there has to be this rising to meet that energy. And we have to train ourselves with great constancy to bring out of ourselves that inner strength. And so Jesus says to his disciples, because you are my disciples, the world will persecute you and the world will despise you. Which, of course, in the history of Christianity, they had some pretty rough times right after he died. And then Jesus says, but don't worry, be of good cheer. He says, I have conquered the world. Isn't that wonderful? Be of good cheer. I often sort of write that out when I'm feeling a little down. Be of good cheer. Be of good cheer. I have conquered the world. And that I, you see, is our own I also. And I was starting to say, especially since Swamiji has come to India in these last years, and you've seen him, those of you who've come here, and will see him again. Almost every time he speaks of Master, he calls him simply my guru. And even when he utters those words, you'll often hear the feeling be so much that he can't even say it. Now, we all long, you know, for an intimate relationship, to be loved, to be able to love. But just think of what an infinity of true love God is really trying to offer us. We cling to my little home, my little body, my little relationship, you know, pleasing this person, pleasing that person, and we get so agitated when a little bit of it is taken away. But the only reason it's being taken away is because God wants to empty our hands so that he can put into it an infinity of bliss. Divine Mother's beneficent loving presence, the Guru's ever-wise guidance. This is what we were born to experience. And to the extent that we have the courage of the heart, which is the courage to direct our heart only toward that infinity, with calm acceptance and joy, to that extent God will fill us.